Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening with Friedrich Schiller. 10 years ago, when the opera The Maltese Cross by Charles Camilleri and Peter Saracino in Glot was premiered in Malta, we focused our attention on the opera and on Schiller's fragment Die Malteser, The Knights of Malta. No other subject had occupied Schiller longer than the idea of writing that play, a tragedy based on the events of the Great Siege of Malta of 1565. The Malteser play was in his mind for at least 15 years, the last 15 years of his life. Schiller got to know details about the Great Siege when he was working on Don Carlos, which he completed in 1787, for which he studied, among other historical sources, the history of the knights by the Abbé de Vertou. He kept coming back to the Malta play until a short time before he died. He corresponded about his ideas with Goethe, Wilhelm von Humboldt, his wife Charlotte Schiller, and with his great admirer and lifelong friend Christian Gottfried Körner. He already had in mind the actors for the play and offered the outstanding German actor of the time, August Wilhelm Iffland, the main role, that of Grandmaster Lavalette. He studied books about Malta and the Order of St. John and ordered at least once a detailed map of the island. Of all his unfinished works for the theater, the Malteser is the one mentioned most often in his correspondence. The Malteser is also the first play listed in the so-called Marbacher Dramenverzeichnis. This was an inventory of subjects and ideas for theatrical works, which Schiller planned to write and which he carried with him for years. It was found in his diary after his death. Unfortunately, the Malteser remained a fragment, or rather, to be more precise, a collection of fragments. 10 years ago, in the publications and discussions that accompanied the opera, we also looked at other works by Schiller thematically related to the Malteser play, mainly, one, his well-known play Don Carlos, in which one of the main characters, the Marquis of Posa, is portrayed as a knight of Malta who had taken part in the Great Siege. Two, the poem Die Johanniter, The Knights of St. John, in which Schiller sings the praises of the order's combined noble ideals of Demut und Kraft, humility and strength. In his opinion, it was that combination of virtues which distinguished the Order of St. John from all similar institutions, which means the humility of the hospitaller, of the nurse, and the strength of the military, the warrior. Three, the ballad Der Kampf mit dem Drachen, The Fight Against the Dragon, one of his most popular poems based on a legend from the time of the knights on the island of Rhodes. This ballad shows the outstanding individual courage of a young knight who fought and killed a dragon that was causing havoc on the island, but whose courage came in conflict with the fundamental knightly rule of obedience, since the Grand Master had ordered everybody to stay away from the dangerous creature. And four, his long and detailed preface to the German version of the Abbé de Vertot's History of the Order, which was published in Germany in 1792-93. Schiller himself had commissioned the German translation when he was professor of history at the University of Jena. Today, we shall be concentrating on one of Schiller's less known works, his unfinished novel, The Ghostseer, Der Geisterseher, The One Who Sees Ghosts. The title, Der Geisterseher, is sometimes translated into English as The Visionary, sometimes also as The Apparitionist, in Italian, Il Visionario. Teresa Frigeri will be reading some extracts from the novel in English translation. There are some very interesting points of contact between the two great figures of German classical literature, Goethe and Schiller, and Malta. This was particularly evident during, although it was not limited to the 5 years from 1786 until 1790. Goethe nearly came here from Sicily on the 27th of April 1787, as he himself recounts in his Italian journey, where he gives details about his wish to visit our island. Malta is also mentioned in the very early versions of Faust. In fact, already in Faust, Ein Fragment, which Schiller published in 1790, but which was written earlier, there is a fleeting reference to Malta. This is when Mephisto reports about the fate of Marthe Schwertlein's husband, who was reported missing. The man had sailed out of Malta on one of the excursions of the galleys of the order when a Turkish vessel laden with treasures was captured, and he could share in the booty. But then nothing was heard from him anymore. Later on, Goethe included this passage in the final version of Faust, Part 1, in the scene Der Nachbarin Haus, the neighbor's house. With Schiller, Goethe discussed the Malteser several times, and on different occasions he encouraged Schiller to finish the play. Even at the age of 78, Goethe was still very interested in Malta, as we know from the private diary of Gustav Partey, who had spent some time here in Malta and who met Goethe on the 23rd of August 1827. Partey reports in his diary that the only subject of his long conversation with Goethe was Malta. He comments that Goethe asked him so many questions about Malta that at times he felt as if he were being examined by him. And one day was not enough. Goethe asked Partey to return on the following day to continue with their conversation about Malta. In the second half of the 1780s, Schiller, completely independently of Goethe, their friendship only started some years later, in 1794, Schiller had been A, working on Don Carlos, as I said, in which the Marquis of Posa's acts of bravery during the siege of St. Elmo are described in detail by the Duke of Alba in Act 3. B, he had got the idea for the Malteser play about the Great Siege. Already in letters written in 1788, he refers to the play, and he had started working on it. And C, between 1786 and 1788, he wrote the novel The Ghost Seer, in which Malta also plays a role. It is a very minor role, but naturally it is of special interest to us, and therefore I shall be referring to it today. As in Goethe's Faust, when Malta is mentioned briefly in Schiller's novel The Ghost Seer, it is also in connection with an adventure at sea which ends up tragically, and also involving vessels belonging to the adversaries. At that time, the Muslim peoples of the Mediterranean, the Turks in Faust, Algerian pirates in the Ghost Seer. In both, Malta is portrayed as a solid rock, a safe haven where the Christian side could take shelter from the fury of tempests while avoiding unexpected clashes with the enemy on the open sea when they didn't seek to engage them themselves. In Europe of the Enlightenment, Malta of the Knights, the traditional bulwark of Europe against the so-called enemies of the cross, still radiated an aura of mythical old legends and exotic tales of chivalry and glory. Then there is another connection with Malta in Schiller's novel. One of the main characters, the one referred to in the novel as the Armenian, is inspired by the notorious figure of Conte Alessandro di Cagliostro. Cagliostro, a contemporary of Schiller and Goethe, was one of the greatest swindlers that the world ever saw. Among many things, he claimed that he could explain the most mysterious events and that he had supernatural powers, including the faculty of summoning up the spirits of the dead. Helped by his many contacts in the Freemasonry and his outstanding charisma, Cagliostro was active all over Europe, reaching the peak of his career in the mid-1780s. Cagliostro himself never gave any information about his real origins, In fact, he created on purpose a sensation of mystery around his descent and the myth around his life. Many researchers have tried to separate truth and legend in the stories concerning Cagliostro, but it must be said that they weren't particularly successful. One thing is certain, however, at the height of his career, his words, including whatever he said about his own life and his Malta connections, were believed and quoted by many. Cagliostro hinted, or claimed, that he was the son of Grandmaster Manuel Pinto de Fonseca, Grandmaster Pinto, and a princess from Trebizond, the Turkish port on the Black Sea. The princess had been captured from a Turkish ship and brought to Malta. Cagliostro said that he believed that he had been born in Malta. At one time, he even produced a document to prove this. After his birth in Malta, he was sent to Arabia. His earliest recollections took him back to the holy city of Medina. He said that in his youth, which he spent in Medina, Mecca, and Egypt, he lived with an Eastern adept, a mysterious man called Altotas, who instructed him in alchemy and the Kabbalah. With him, he traveled to many Mediterranean countries. According to Cagliostro, it was this Altotas, this adeptus, who put in the young man's mind the idea that he was born of noble Christian parents, but he refused to tell him more. According to Cagliostro, it was on a French ship coming from Rhodes that, together with Altotas, he arrived in Malta. Here, the two men were taken under the protection of Grandmaster Pinto, who let them stay at his palace and who was particularly kind to Cagliostro. They didn't need to undergo the strict quarantine controls applicable at the time for anyone coming from the Eastern Mediterranean. The Grandmaster, who was keen to enhance his own knowledge of alchemy, was allegedly very interested in Cagliostro's experiments and let him use his laboratory. According to one version of Cagliostro's life, his companion Altotas died as a result of an accident which happened during one of the experiments and was buried in Malta. It seems that it was in Malta that Cagliostro adopted the name Cagliostro and with it European clothes. He claimed to have been initiated into the Sovereign Military Order of the Knights. While nobody knows for certain who Cagliostro really was, most historians hold the view that in reality he was Giuseppe Balsamo, born in Palermo, Sicily on June 2, 1743. The man was so well known that even Goethe went out of his way to meet Balsamo's family and visit his birthplace when he was in Palermo during his Italian journey in 1786-1787. When Goethe went back to Weimar after his stay in Italy, he reported in great detail about everything he managed to get concerning Balsamo. Some years later, he wrote a comedy based on the figure of Cagliostro, where the main character is the Conte di Rostro. During the time of the Enlightenment, when reason ruled the world, when what was based on ratio was intrinsically good, the roving adventurer and alchemist Cagliostro appealed to the dark side of humanity, to the unreasonable, the unexplainable, to what was beyond reason, and to supernatural powers which the human mind could not comprehend. Cagliostro's reputation suffered a great blow when it was alleged that he was involved in the scandal of the affair of the diamond necklace at the French court of Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette in 1785. When he was arrested by the police in Paris, he said he didn't know how old he was, but he did say that he was of Maltese African origin. A famous and fascinating character, nonetheless, who also had connections with Malta, all very dubious, but again very well known all over Europe in the second half of the 18th century, so much so that in some publications he is even referred to as Maltese. While many, including heads of states and even respected scholars and scientists, believed in his supernatural powers and the powers of Cagliostro il Divino, Others, even when he was at the peak of his career, considered him a charlatan and dangerous. Schiller was one of those who never accepted any of the claims that Cagliostro made. Following a visit by Cagliostro to Strasbourg, one of the most successful events of his life, when it was reported that he had healed thousands of patients magnetically, in a short report entitled Cagliostro, viel Lärmens um nichts, Cagliostro, Much Ado About Nothing, which Schiller published in 1782, Schiller denounced him as an imposter. Schiller followed Cagliostro's life and his influence on people very closely. As I have said already, the character of the Armenian in the novel The Ghost Seer is modeled on the figure of this Cagliostro. We shall get back to this Armenian very soon. Before we leave Cagliostro, let me give you just one historical piece of information which is very relevant to Schiller's novel. This concerns the political situation in the German state of Württemberg. For a very long time, the capital city was Stuttgart. Schiller was born and grew up in Württemberg. In fact, he called it his Vaterland. The succession to the throne of Württemberg was, at the time when Schiller wrote the novel, not clear at all. The state was traditionally a Protestant stronghold. Even until 1905, 100 years ago that is, 70% of the inhabitants of Württemberg were Protestants. But many suspected that the Jesuits were trying hard to thwart the Protestant hold on the Württemberg throne. In 1786, when Schiller got the idea for the novel, an excellent investigative report was published by Elisa von der Recke, in which she exposed Cagliostro's so-called supernatural powers as mere magic and fraud. Elisa von der Recke was an outstanding personality of the German Enlightenment and its immediate aftermath. Soon after, Prince Friedrich Eugen of Württemberg wrote a strong-worded essay in reaction to Elisa von der Recke's report. In his essay, which was published in July 1788 in the reputable Berlinische Monatsschrift, Prince Friedrich Eugen defended the significance of trying to summon up ghosts for religious purposes. Then he even hinted that he was not averse to a possible conversion to Catholicism. Schiller knew these two publications very well. Naturally, he was on the side of Elisa von der Recke. It was exactly during this period, that is, the 2 years between 1786 and 1788, that Schiller wrote his novel. The Ghost Seer is an amazingly mysterious story. It involves ghosts, the most obscure characters, unexplainable coincidences, artificially created wonders, and some very shocking events. All the action takes place in the labyrinths of Venice. Ladies and gentlemen, do not worry. We are not going to invoke any spirits here tonight. You will hear about them, but they will remain nicely and safely locked up in Schiller's novel. And there are other things that you shouldn't worry about. This is not going to be another eulogy to the great Friedrich Schiller. I believe that Schiller has suffered enough because of the never-ending praise to which he has been subjected for so long. Many students of German shudder at the name of Friedrich Schiller. He is considered to be simply very difficult, his German sentence structures too complicated, his vocabulary too rich and laden with images from Greek and Latin literature, his imagery too deeply anchored in German traditions, which a foreigner is often not familiar with and therefore finds it very difficult to understand. Or else, by the time he has understood, the pleasure is gone. As for native speakers of German, many find Schiller too classical and idealistic, too strenuously intellectual, far removed from the concerns and problems which trouble postmodern men and women. His language is often marked by a pathetic sentimentality that doesn't appeal to contemporary readers and audiences. Not many may sympathize with Nietzsche, who disparagingly once referred to Schiller as der Moraltrompeter von Säckingen, the boring moralist. But there is no doubt that many think that in most of his works, Schiller is a pedantic moralizer. My idea this evening is to look at a very different aspect of Schiller. To this day, especially in Germany, Schiller is the victim of legend, indeed of the cult that arose around him during the 19th century. Already towards the end of his life, especially following his death in 1805, he started being treated like a god. For decades, he was portrayed as an overwhelming national hero, his works used and misused for political purposes. There isn't a town in Germany that doesn't have its Schillerplatz or Schillerstraße, its Schiller Park or at least a Schillergasse. There must be hundreds of schools, student hostels and hotels proudly bearing his name. The same applies to the other German-speaking countries and regions of Europe. Schiller's William Tell is considered to be the national play of the Swiss. The Austrians lay claim to Schiller just as much as the Germans. After all, when Schiller was alive, Germany did not exist as a united country. Here you see the great monument at one of the most prominent squares in Vienna. Quotations from his plays and poems were and still often are found to fit any occasion. All Germans of a certain age will tell you that at school they were forced to learn by heart one of his longer poems, usually Das Lied von der Glocke, the Song of the Bell, a poem, believe it or not, of 436 lines, which they had to learn by heart. In time, excessive praise coupled with force feeding at school could not but bring about a reaction of boredom and outright rejection among German native speakers. All this, together with the fact that Schiller, alongside Goethe, was, again, soon after his birth, elevated to the rank of classica, setting him apart from and above authors of his own age, and many others before and after, made Schiller a double victim of his own legend. During the past 20 years or so, we have been experiencing a slow but steady counter-movement emphasizing the human qualities of the author Schiller, looking at him not as a god but as a man through and through, whose works reflect, first of all, his own experiences and then the problems and aspirations not only of the German people but of many Europeans in the second half of the 18th and the beginning of the 19th century. A report by the German news agency Deutscher Depeschendienst about the exhibition that has been put up at the Schiller Nationalmuseum in Marbach, which you see here, to commemorate the 200th anniversary of his death, just published by the journalist Brigitte Fritz-Kador. This report is entitled Schiller vom Olymp geholt, Schiller brought down from Olympus, Mount Olympus. The highest mountain in Greece was, in Greek mythology, the dwelling place of the greater gods. The exhibition in Marbach shows Schiller in his everyday life, with his joys and worries, hopes and disillusions. The exhibition itself is entitled Götterpläne und Mäusegeschäfte. Götterpläne are divine plans, while Mäusegeschäfte means literally the work of mice, the everyday chores, petty business deals. Of divine plans and the work of mice is a phrase taken from The Robbers, Die Räuber, Schiller's first major work for the theater and his first huge success with the public. The phrase sums up his own life. His life, which was marked by these two contrasting poles. On the one hand, his divine plans, the ongoing, never flagging quest for new creative ideas, for plays, poems and essays, mainly on literary theory, and on the other hand, the seemingly endless struggle for survival. Schiller himself definitely thought of the novel Die Ghostsia as one of his Mäusegeschäfte. He wrote it to fill up the pages in the Thalia, the literary magazine which he edited. It proved to be one of the most popular of his works, mainly because it treated in masterly style the theme of experiments in the supernatural. This subject was extremely topical at the time, not least due to the household name of Cagliostro. At the same time, it is a great thriller. When the first installments appeared, everybody spoke of it. Both critics and readers showered great praise on the author. The public loved the mysterious events, the intrigue and the suspense, and looked forward to the next episode and didn't want it to finish. A kind of Dallas of the late 18th century. The readers were fascinated by the riddle itself and were not so keen about knowing the answer. For his part, although his heart was never really in it, because he didn't consider it to be good literature, Schiller made it as long as possible, thereby earning more money. At that time, he had no other income except the little he earned from his literary activities. For most of his life, Schiller was a poor man and very ill. Weren't it for friends and admirers who repeatedly came to his rescue, and for his ability to convince publishers and theater managers to pay him for his works in advance, his life would have been even more miserable, and probably he would have died much earlier. It was only towards the end of his life that he could put money problems behind him. By then, however, not much of his life was left. His father was a low-ranking army officer. His Protestant parents would have liked him to become a pastor, naturally a pastor of the Protestant church. However, the autocratic Duke of Württemberg forced him at the age of 14 to join his military academy near Stuttgart, where promising boys were trained for the Duke's army and the civil service of the state of Württemberg. He was made to study law, but later was allowed to change to medicine. Therefore, by training and profession, Schiller was a qualified medical doctor. But very early in life, he realized that his vocation was in the field of literature. Because he wanted to practice freely his chosen profession, for which he actually coined the word in German Dichterberuf, the job, the profession of an author, he suffered political oppression, was jailed, went into exile, experienced all kinds of physical deprivations and psychological humiliations, became seriously ill at the age of 31, and dedicated as he was to his work, he never even gave his body the chance to recover properly, with the result that he died 200 years ago on the 9th of May 1805 at the age of 45, at the height of his literary powers. I would now like to ask Mrs. Teresa Frigieri to read for us the first extract from Schiller's Der Geisterseher.
The Geisterseher by Friedrich Schiller, Book One. From the papers of Count O. I am about to relate an adventure which to many will appear incredible, but of which I was in great part an eyewitness. The few who are acquainted with a certain political event will, if indeed these pages should happen to find them alive, receive a welcome solution thereof. And even to the rest of my readers, it will be, perhaps, important as a contribution to the history of the deception and aberrations of the human intellect. The boldness of the schemes which malice is able to contemplate and to carry out must excite astonishment, as must also the means of which it can avail itself to accomplish its aims. Clear, unvarnished truth shall guide my pen. For when these pages come before the public, I shall be no more, and shall therefore never learn their fate. On my return to Courland, about the time of the carnival, I visited the prince in Venice. We had been acquainted in the service, and we here renewed an intimacy which, by restoration of peace, had been interrupted. As I wished to see the curiosities of this city, And as the prince was waiting only for the arrival of remittances to return to his native country, he easily prevailed on me to tarry till his departure. We agreed not to separate during the time of our residence in Venice, and the prince was kind enough to accommodate me at his lodgings at the Moor Hotel. As the prince wished to enjoy himself, and his small revenues did not permit him to maintain the dignity of his rank, he lived in Venice in the strictest incognito. Two noblemen, in whom he had entire confidence, and a few faithful servants, composed all his retinue. He shunned expenditure, more, however, from inclination than economy. He avoided all kinds of dissipation, and up to the age of 35 years, had resisted the numerous allurements of this voluptuous city. To the charms of the fair sex, he was wholly indifferent. A settled gravity and an enthusiastic melancholy were the prominent features of his character. His affections were tranquil, but obstinate to excess. He formed his attachments with caution and timidity, but once formed, they were cordial and permanent. In the midst of a tumultuous crowd, he walked in solitude. Wrapped in his own visionary ideas, he was often a stranger to the world about him. And sensible of his own deficiency in the knowledge of mankind, he scarcely ever ventured an opinion of his own, and was apt to play an unwarrantable deference to the judgment of others. Though far from being weak, no man was more liable to be governed. But when conviction had once entered his mind, he became firm and decisive, equally courageous to combat an acknowledged prejudice or to die for a new one. As he was the third prince of his house, he had no likely prospect of succeeding to the sovereignty. His ambition had never been awakened. His passions had taken another direction. Contented to find himself independent of the will of others, he never enforced his own as law. His utmost wishes did not soar beyond the peaceful quietude of a private life, free from care. He read much, but without discrimination. As his education had been neglected, and as he had early entered the career of arms, his understanding had never been fully matured. Hence, the knowledge he afterwards acquired served but to increase the chaos of his ideas, because it was built on an unstable foundation. He was a Protestant, as all his family had been, by birth, but not by investigation, which he had never attempted, although at one period of his life he had been an enthusiast in its cause. He had never, so far as came to my knowledge, been a Freemason. One evening we were, as usual, walking by ourselves, well masked, in the square of St. Mark. It was growing late, and the crowd was dispersing, when the prince observed a mask which followed us everywhere. This mask was an Armenian, and walked alone. We quickened our steps and endeavored to baffle him by repeatedly altering our course. It was in vain. The mask was always close behind us. "You have had no intrigue here, I hope," said the prince at last. "The husbands of Venice are dangerous." "I do not know a single lady in the place," was my answer. "Let us sit down here and speak German," said he. "I fancy we are mistaken for some other persons." We sat down upon a stone bench and expected the mask would have passed by. He came directly up to us and took his seat by the side of the prince. The latter took out his watch and, rising at the same time, addressed me thus in a loud voice in French. "It is past 9. Come, we forget that we are waited for at the Louvre." This speech he only invented in order to deceive the mask as to our route. 9, repeated the latter in the same language, in a slow and expressive voice. "Congratulate yourself, my prince," calling him by his real name. "He died at 9. In saying this, he rose and went away. We looked at each other in amazement. "Who is dead?" said the prince at length, after a long silence. "Let us follow him," replied I, "and demand an explanation." We searched every corner of the place. The mask was nowhere to be found. We returned to our hotel, disappointed. The prince spoke not a word to me the whole way. He walked apart by himself and appeared to be greatly agitated, which he afterwards confessed to me was the case. Having reached home, he began at length to speak. "Is it not laughable," said he, "that a madman should have the power thus to disturb a man's tranquillity by two or three words?" We wished each other a good night, and as soon as I was in my own apartment, I noted down in my pocketbook the day and the hour when this adventure happened. It was on a Thursday. The next evening, the prince said to me, "Suppose we go to the square of St. Mark and seek for our mysterious Armenian. I long to see this comedy unraveled." I consented. We walked in the square till 11. The Armenian was nowhere to be seen. We repeated our walk the four following evenings, and each time with the same bad success. On the sixth evening, as we went out of the hotel, it occurred to me, whether designedly or otherwise I cannot recollect, to tell the servants where we might be found in case we should be inquired for. The prince remarked my precaution and approved of it with a smile. We found the square of St. Mark very much crowded. Scarcely had we advanced 30 steps when I perceived the Armenian, who was pressing rapidly through the crowd and seemed to be in search of someone. We were just approaching him when Baron F., one of the prince's retinue, came up to us quite breathless and delivered to the prince a letter. "It is sealed with black," said he, "and we supposed from this that it might contain matters of importance." I was struck as with a thunderbolt. The prince went near a torch and began to read. "My cousin is dead," exclaimed he. "When?" inquired I, anxiously interrupting him. He looked again into the letter. Last Thursday night at 9. We had not discovered, and we had not recovered from our surprise, when the Armenian stood before us. "You are known here, my prince," said he. "Hasten to your hotel. You will find there the deputies from the Senate. Do not hesitate to accept the honor they intend to offer you. Baron, I forgot to tell you that your remittances are arrived." And he disappeared among the crowd. We hastened to our hotel and found everything as the Armenian had told us. Three noblemen of the Republic were waiting to pay their respects to the prince and to escort him in state to the assembly, where the first nobility of the city were ready to receive him. He had hardly time enough to give me a hint to sit up for him till his return. About 11 o'clock at night, he returned. On entering the room, he appeared grave and thoughtful. Having dismissed the servants, he took me by the hand and said, in the words of Hamlet, "Count, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy."
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the opening of Schiller's unfinished novel, The Ghosts Here. The first half is supposedly taken from the memoirs of the Count of O. The rest consists of 10 letters written by the Baron of F from Venice to the Count of O in Germany. At the end, after the Baron's 10th letter, there is a short conclusion, again written by the Count of O. Nearly all the characters mentioned in the novel are not referred to by name, or only the first letter of their name is given, the Count of O, the Baron of F. The story itself is totally the fruit of Schiller's imagination, but there are several historical connotations and interesting undertones. The main character is a prince, a German prince from one of the noble houses ruling the many German states at the time when Schiller was writing, the second half of the 18th century. There is a count and a baron, both Germans, one a friend of the prince, the other belonging to his retinue, a weird Armenian and a very odd Sicilian, an inexplicably beautiful Greek woman. There are strange murders, an electric machine, troops of ghosts, and there is even an English lord. As you have just heard, the unattached German Protestant prince lives modestly in Venice in strictest incognito with his companion, the Count of O. This Serenissima Venice radiates a nostalgic aura of splendor and glory. However, the city of the Doges and Saint Mark is not free from decadence and corruption, and even the Catholic Church is not immune to these blemishes. Actually, Schiller was very critical, not of the religious dimension, but of the Church's conspicuous pursuit of political power and earthly gain. We find him taking the stance several times, very clearly, for example, in his historical plays Don Carlos and Maria Stuart. As Schiller's novel progresses, first the strange Armenian and later on a Sicilian adventurer seek to gain power over the prince. We heard in the first reading the enigmatic words uttered by the Armenian, actually a masked man in Armenian clothes. 9. Congratulate yourself, prince. He died at 9. 9 Uhr. Wünschen Sie sich Glück, Prinz. 9 Uhr ist er gestorben. The masks, naturally, are also significant in this context. Nothing is what it seems. With his words, the Armenian foretells the death of the prince's cousin. This dead cousin was the only son of the very old and sickly king who ruled the German state where the prince came from. The cousin was next in line to the throne. As a result of his demise, the only man between the prince and the throne was now the king's brother, also an elderly man who had no children. Considering that the heir to the throne, the cousin, was dead, and that both the king and the uncle were advanced in age, soon it would be the turn of the prince to accede to the throne. That is why the Armenian congratulates him. Initially, the idea of becoming a king does not excite the prince at all. In fact, at the beginning of the novel, when he understands what the Armenian's words mean, he shows very clearly that he would be reluctant to accept the crown. The Armenian, however, impresses the prince with more prophecies which turn out to be true. He often appears from nowhere to explain the most extraordinary events. A plot characterized by intrigue and many strange coincidences, suggesting supernatural involvement, starts to unfold. The mysterious Armenian seems to be directly or indirectly implicated in everything that happens. At first, the modest and honest prince is confused. He seeks to find logical explanations and return to solid ground. He is not foolish. He will not automatically look at anything enigmatic as supernatural. But he is too inquisitive, and he is so impressed by the incomprehensible developments around him that he does not manage to take a radical decision and step back. Soon, the count tells us, the prince's curiosity was raised to the highest pitch. Die Neugierde des Prinzen war auf den höchsten Grad gespannt. We learn later on from the Count's comments that the prince's character had always been marked with a strong curiosity about the supernatural. We heard him quoting Hamlet's words, "There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy." He was not only inclined to accept the possibility of the supernatural, he wished to come in contact with the supernatural. He found irresistible everything which was incomprehensible, and the Count tells us, since the first appearance of the Armenian, all the ideas that his more mature reason had refused had been revived in him. Seit jener ersten Erscheinung des Armeniers hatten sich alle Ideen wieder bei ihm gemeldet, die seine reifere Vernunft so lange abgewiesen hatte. The prince's more mature reason, his reifere Vernunft, had made him refuse his original fascination with the supernatural. He had moved away from the world of fantasy, prejudice and darkness towards the rational, logical and sober world of the Enlightenment. But, after coming under the influence of the Armenian, the prince reverts to his former way of thinking. He starts to believe that he has come under the spell of some strange power. After one of the many unexplainable things that happened to him, he tells his companion, the Count, "A superior power attends me. Omniscience surrounds me. An invisible being whom I cannot escape watches over my steps. And even in this case, he concludes by telling his friend, I must seek for the Armenian and obtain an explanation from him. The Armenian becomes his guide and mentor. He pulls the strings, produces ghostly apparitions, and brings about moments of religious ecstasy. The prince is at the mercy of secretive powers. The dark side of the Enlightenment has taken hold of him. Die dunkle Seite, die Nachtseite, die Kehrseite der Aufklärung. Slowly and irresistibly, he sinks deeper into the apparent endless abyss of the mysterious and the occult. He even goes as far as to believe a Sicilian magician who promises to summon up his, the prince's, dead friend in a conjuration. The scene is an important one in the novel. The Sicilian seems to actually manage to convince his audience, but towards the end of the seance, a second ghost makes his violent appearance, and the Sicilian's attempt is exposed as a fraud. The trickster is unmasked, arrested, and imprisoned for imposture. Hidden vaults, narrow staircases leading to cellars, an electrical machine, clocks and silver bells, all form part of his backstage and props, along with, as the Count reports in his narration, I quote, a hole which had been made in the window shutter opposite the chimney, which opened and shut with a slide. In this hole was fixed a magic lantern, from which the figure of the conjured ghost had been reflected on the opposite wall. Over the chimney from the garret and the cellar, the police, when he was arrested, brought several drums to which large leaden bullets were fastened by strings. These had probably been used to imitate the roaring of thunder which we had heard. It is during the meeting between the prince and the Sicilian in prison that Malta is mentioned, as in the case of Goethe's Faust, very briefly, en passant, just to create a mood. An image which the mention of Malta evoked among the reading public at the time. The island of the remarkable order of the Knights of St. John, lying between Europe and Africa in the middle of a distant sea, one of the most dangerous stretches of water. The Sicilian recounts an episode which involved both him and the Armenian. Let us listen to part of his story. This time we go to Naples.
It is about 5 years ago, began the Sicilian, that at Naples, where I was practicing my art with tolerable success, I became acquainted with a person of the name of Lorenzo, Chevalier of the Order of St. Stephen, a young and rich nobleman of one of the first families in the kingdom, who loaded me with kindnesses and seemed to have a great esteem for my occult knowledge. He told me that the Marquis, his father, was a zealous admirer of the Kabbalah and would think himself happy in having a philosopher like myself, for such he was pleased to call me, under his roof. The Marquis lived in one of his country seats on the seashore, about 7 miles from Naples. There, almost entirely secluded from the world, he bewailed the loss of a beloved son, of whom he had been deprived by a terrible calamity. The Chevalier gave me to understand that he and his family might perhaps have occasion to employ me on a matter of the most grave importance, in the hope of gaining through my secret science some information, to procure which all natural means had been tried in vain. He added, with a very significant look, that he himself might, perhaps at some future period, have reason to look upon me as the restorer of his tranquility and of all his earthly happiness. The affair was as follows. This Lorenzo was the younger son of the Marquis, and for that reason had been destined for the church. The family estates were to descend to the eldest. Geronimo, which was the name of the latter, had spent many years on his travels, and had returned to his country about 7 years prior to the event which I'm about to relate, in order to celebrate his marriage with the only daughter of the neighboring count. The marriage had been determined on by the parents during the infancy of the children, in order to unite the large fortunes of the two houses. But though this agreement was made by the two families, without consulting the heart of the parties concerned, the latter had mutually pledged their faith to each other in secret. Geronimo and Antonia had been brought up together, and the little restraint imposed on two children, whom their parents were already accustomed to regard as destined for each other, soon produced between them a connection of the tenderest kind. The congeniality of their tempers cemented this intimacy, and in later years it ripened insensibly to love. An absence of 4 years, far from cooling this passion, had only served to inflame it, and Geronimo returned to the arms of his intended bride as faithful and as ardent as if they had never been separated. The raptures occasioned by his return had not yet subsided, and the preparations for the happy day were advancing with the utmost zeal and activity, when the bridegroom disappeared. He used frequently to spend whole afternoons in a summer house which commanded the prospect of the sea, and was accustomed to take the diversion of sailing on the water. One day, on an evening spent in this manner, it was observed that he remained absent a much longer time than usual, and his friends began to be very uneasy on his account. Messengers were dispatched after him. Vessels were sent to sea in quest of him. No person had seen him. None of his servants were missed. He must therefore have gone alone. Night came on, and he did not appear. The next morning dawned. The day passed. The evening succeeded. Geronimo came not. Already they had begun to give themselves up to the most melancholy conjectures when the news arrived that an Algerian pirate had landed the preceding day on that coast and carried off several of the inhabitants. Two galleys which were ready for sea were immediately manned. The old Marquis himself embarked in one of them to attempt the deliverance of his son at the peril of his own life. On the third morning they perceived the courser. They had the advantage of the wind. They were just about to overtake the pirate, and had even approached so near that Lorenzo, who was in one of the galleys, fancied that he saw upon the deck of the adversary's ship a signal made by his brother, when a sudden storm separated the vessels. Hardly could the damaged galleys sustain the fury of the tempest. The pirate, in the meantime, had disappeared, and the distressed state of the other vessels obliged them to land at Malta. The affliction of the family knew no bounds. The distracted old Marquis tore his grey hairs in the utmost violence of grief, and fears were entertained for the life of the young Countess. 5 years were consumed in fruitless inquiries. Diligent search was made along all the coast of Barbary. Immense sums of money were offered for the ransom of the poor Marquis, but no person came forward to claim them. The only probable conjecture which remained for the family to form was that the same storm which had separated the galleys from the pirate had destroyed the latter, and that the whole ship's company had perished in the waves. But, however the supposition might be, it did not by any means amount to a certainty, and could not authorize the family altogether to renounce the hope that the lost Geronimo might again appear. In case, however, that he was really dead, either the family must become extinct, or the younger son must relinquish the church and assume the rights of the elder.
I will now summarize part of the strange story of the Sicilian, and then Teresa will read the last bit. The Sicilian is engaged, quote, to disturb the repose of the dead for the sake of the living. It is decided that he should summon the spirit of the deceased brother Geronimo. The family members were prepared for the solemn occasion by mystical instruction, fasting, solitude, and special prayers, all coordinated by the Sicilian. The Sicilian explains to the prince all the tricks he used for this seance. He had prepared everything so well and with so much detail that when Geronimo's spirit was summoned and it appeared, the family were totally convinced that he was no more. They publicly announced his death and went into mourning. After the many trials that both the surviving brother Lorenzo and his former bride-to-be Antonia had gone through, it was decided that they would marry, once Geronimo was surely dead. A splendid banquet was prepared in the superb hall decorated with wonderful illuminations. The most lively and delightful music was played, and many guests were invited. It was already very late at night, when the feast was nearing its end. The Sicilian continues his narration as follows.
In the midst of the throng, the Sicilian paused, a trembling expectation suspended our breath. In the midst of the throng, continued the prisoner, appeared a Franciscan monk, to whom my attention was directed by the person who sat next to me at table. He was standing motionless like a marble pillar. His shape was tall and thin, his face pale and ghastly. His eyes were fixed with a grave and mournful expression on the new married couple. The joy which beamed on the face of everyone present appeared not on his. His countenance never once varied. He seemed like a statue among the living. Such an object, appearing amidst the general joy, struck me more forcibly from its contrast with everything around. It left on my mind so indelible an impression that from it alone I have been enabled, which would otherwise have been impossible, to recollect the features of the Franciscan monk in the Russian officer. For without doubt, you must have already conceived that the person I have described was no other than your Armenian. I frequently attempted to withdraw my eyes from this terrible figure, but they wandered back involuntarily and found his countenance unaltered. I pointed him out to the person who sat nearest to me on the other side, and he did the same to the person next to him. In a few minutes, a general curiosity and astonishment pervaded the whole company. The conversation languished. A general silence succeeded. The monk did not heed it. He continued motionless as before, his grave and mournful looks constantly fixed upon the new married couple. His appearance struck everyone with terror. The young countess alone, who found the transcript of her own sorrow in the fact of the stranger, beheld with a melancholy satisfaction the only object that seemed to understand and sympathize in her sufferings. The crowd insensibly diminished. It was past midnight. The music became fainter and more languid. The tapers grew dim, and many of them went out. The conversation, declining by degrees, lost itself at last in secret murmurs, and the faintly illuminated hall was nearly deserted. The monk, in the meantime, continued motionless, with the same grave and mournful look still fixed on the new married couple. The company at length rose from the table, the guests dispersed, the family assembled in a separate group, and the monk, though uninvited, continued near them. How it happened that no person spoke to him, I cannot conceive. The female friends now surrounded the trembling bride, who cast a supplicating and distressed look on the venerable stranger. He did not answer it. The gentlemen assembled in the same manner around the bridegroom. A solemn and anxious silence prevailed among them. "That we should be so happy here together," began at length the old Marquis, who alone seemed not to behold the stranger, or at least seemed to behold him without dismay. "That we should be so happy here together, and my son Geronimo cannot be with us." "Have you invited him, and has he failed to come?" asked the monk. It was the first time he had spoken. We looked at him in alarm. "Alas, he is gone to a place from whence there is no return," answered the old man. "Reverend Father, you misunderstood me. My son Geronimo is dead." "Perhaps he only fears to appear in this company," replied the monk. "Who knows how your son Geronimo may be situated? Let him now hear the voice which he heard the last. Desire your son Lorenzo to call him." "What means he?" whispered the company to one another. Lorenzo changed color. I will not deny that my own hair began to stand on end. In the meantime, the monk approached the sideboard. He took a glass of wine and carried it to his lips. "To the memory of our dear Geronimo," said he, "let everyone who loved the deceased follow my example." "Be you who you may be, Reverend Father," exclaimed the old Marquis, "you have pronounced a name dear to us all, and you are heartily welcome here." Then turning to us, he offered us full glasses. "Come, my friends," continued he, "let us not be surpassed by a stranger. The memory of my son Geronimo." Never, I believe, was any toast less heartily received. "There is one glass still unemptied," said the Marquis. "Why does my son Lorenzo refuse to drink this friendly toast?" Lorenzo, trembling, received the glass from the hands of the monk. Tremblingly, he put it to his lips. "To my dearly beloved brother Geronimo," he stammered out, and replaced the glass with a shudder. "That was my murderer's voice," exclaimed a terrible figure, which appeared suddenly in the midst of us all, covered with blood and disfigured with horrible wounds. "Do not ask me the rest," added the Sicilian, with every symptom of horror in his countenance. "I lost my senses the moment I looked at this apparition. The same happened to everyone present. When we recovered, the monk and the ghost had disappeared. Lorenzo was writhing in the agonies of death. He was carried to bed in the most dreadful convulsions. No person attended him but his confessor and the sorrowful old Marquis, in whose presence he expired. The Marquis died a few weeks after him. Lorenzo's secret is locked in the bosom of the priest who received his last confession. No person ever learnt what it was. Soon after this event, a well was cleaned in the farmyard of the Marquis's villa. It had been disused for many years and was almost closed up by shrubs and trees. On digging among the rubbish, a human skeleton was found. The house where this happened is now no more. The family is extinct, and Antonia's tomb may be seen in a convent not far from Salerno.
In the second part of the novel, we find that the prince's character has changed completely. You remember that at the beginning of the novel, he shunned expenditure, avoided all kinds of dissipation, resisted the numerous allurements of the voluptuous city. As a result of his experiences in Venice with the Armenian and the Sicilian, the prince, brought up to regard religion with total respect and awe, succumbs to skepticism and free thinking. He joins a private secret society called the Bucentauro and becomes a very active member. The Count describes this society as one which, I quote, "under the mask of a noble and rational liberality of sentiment, encouraged the most unbridled licentiousness of manners and opinion. Some of its members were priests, and there were even cardinals at its head. It had its secret degrees, and everyone who entered the society was obliged, at least as long as he continued to be a member of it, to lay aside all distinctions arising from rank, nation, or religion. In short, every mark or distinction, whatever, and to submit himself to the condition of universal equality." The prince was especially attracted to the society because it boasted of the most cultivated taste. At the same time, equality between all the members was a fundamental principle. The Bucentauro, as portrayed by Schiller, was one of the secret societies that emerged in the last quarter of the 18th century, based, at least initially, on the philosophy of the Radical Enlightenment, like the group of the Illuminists, which was founded in Germany by Adam Weishaupt in 1776. The effect of the secret society on the character of the prince is immense. First of all, he starts to question his convictions, especially his strong, almost ascetic Protestant religious principles. Then, through his involvement with the Bucentauro and the people he came to know there, he, I quote, "launched out into the torrent of the great world. His threshold was eternally thronged when he was at home. Amusements, banquets, and galas followed each other in rapid succession. He was the idol whom everyone courted, the great attraction of every circle. Whatever he uttered was admirable, and when he remained silent, it was like committing a robbery upon the company. The prince starts living beyond his means. Very soon we find him playing for money and incurring very heavy debts. The artificially exaggerated attention given to him by the members of the Bucentauro leads him to believe that he has been accepted in the sphere of the knowledgeable. This boosts his ego tremendously. He has not only lost his modern disposition, he has become vain, conceited and arrogant. In the words of the Count, parasites had poisoned his heart. Ambition is the next step. The prince is ready for the big jump, which previously he refused to even consider. He is prepared to become king. In a church, a Catholic church, he falls in love with an extremely beautiful woman, whom he sees for the first time like in a vision. He believes that she must be Greek. In the fifth letter, which the Baron of F writes to the Count of O, he gives an account of the first meeting between the prince and the Greek woman.
The prince had dismissed us early, but a thousand reflections flitted across my brain and kept me awake. For a long time I could hear him pacing up and down his room. At length sleep overcame me. Late at midnight I was awakened by a voice, and I felt a hand passed across my face. I opened my eyes and saw the prince standing at my bedside with a lamp in his hand. He told me he was unable to sleep and begged me to keep him company through the night. I was going to dress myself, but he told me to stay where I was and seated himself at my bedside. "Something has happened to me today," he began, "the impression of which will never be effaced from my soul. I left you, as you know, to see the church, respecting which Civitella had raised my curiosity and which had already attracted my attention. As neither you nor he were at hand, I walked a short distance alone and ordered Biondello to wait for me at the door. The church was quite empty. A dim and solemn light surrounded me as I entered from the blazing, sultry day without. I stood alone in the spacious building, throughout which there reigned the stillness of the grave. I placed myself in the center of the church and gave myself up to the feelings which the sight was calculated to produce. By degrees, the grand proportions of this majestic building expanded to my gaze, and I stood wrapped in deep and pleasing contemplation. Above me, the evening bell was tolling. Its tones died softly away in the aisles and found an echo in my heart. Some altar pieces at a distance attracted my attention. I approached to look at them. Unconsciously, I had wandered through one side of the church and was now standing at the opposite end. Here, a few steps raised round the pillar led into a little chapel containing several small altars with statues of saints in the niches above them. On entering the chapel on the right, I heard a whispering, as though someone near was speaking in a low voice. I turned towards the spot whence the sound proceeded and saw before me a female form. No, I cannot describe to you the beauty of this form. My first feeling was one of awe, which, however, soon gave place to ravishing surprise. But this figure, Your Highness, are you certain that it was something living, something real, and not perhaps a picture or an illusion of your fancy? Hear me further. It was a lady. Surely, till that moment, I have never seen her sex in its full perfection. All around was somber. The setting sun shone through a single window into the chapel, and its rays rested upon her figure. With inexpressible grace, half kneeling, half lying, she was stretched before an altar. One of the most striking, most lovely and picturesque objects in all of nature. Her dress was of black moreen, fitting tightly to her slender waist and beautifully formed arms, the skirt spreading around her like a Spanish robe. Her long, light-colored hair was divided into two broad plaits, which apparently, from their own weight, had escaped from under her veil and flowed in charming disorder down her back. One of her hands grasped a crucifix, and her head rested gracefully upon the other. But where shall I find words to describe to you the angelic beauty of her countenance, in which the charms of a seraph seemed displayed? The setting sun shone full upon her face, and its golden beams seemed to surround it as with a glory. Can you recall to your mind the Madonna of our Florentine painter? She was here personified, even to those few deviations from the studied costume which so powerfully, so irresistibly attracted me in the picture.
In his last letter to the Count in Germany, the Baron gives him the latest news from Venice. He also reports about the complete rupture between the Prince and his family in Germany, about very serious problems, and also about the Greek woman. I quote, "You are no doubt impatient, dear O, to hear something definite with respect to the Greek. But in truth, I have very little to tell you. From the Prince I can learn nothing, as he has been admitted into her confidence and is, I believe, bound in secrecy. The fact has, however, transpired that she is not Greek, as we supposed, but a German of the highest descent. From a certain report that has reached me, it would appear that her mother is of the most exalted rank, and that she is the fruit of an unfortunate amour, which was once talked of all over Europe. A course of secret persecution, to which she has been exposed in consequence of her origin, compelled her to seek protection in Venice. He is devoted to her with a fearful intensity of passion, which increases day by day. There is scarce a day on which the prince is not with her. Whole evenings pass without our even seeing him, and when he is not with her, she appears to form the sole object of his thoughts. His whole being seems metamorphosized. He goes about as if wrapped in a dream, and nothing that formerly interested him has now power to arrest his attention even for a moment." A report about the prince sent to his family in Germany says, "He is overwhelmed with debts, puts his confidence in visionaries and charlatans, who pretend to have power over spirits, maintains suspicious relations with Roman Catholic prelates, and keeps up a degree of state which exceeds both his rank and his means. It is even said that he is about to bring this highly offensive conduct to a climax by apostasy to the Church of Rome." The Protestant prince is considering converting to Roman Catholicism. The moral degradation shows itself in the prince's new desire for power on the one hand, and through his liaison with the beautiful Greek woman, in his gradual willingness to surrender to the seductive sensuousness of the Catholic Church on the other. When the Count of O does not receive the Baron's promised 11th letter, he returns in haste to Venice. The Greek woman has been poisoned by someone who wants to get her out of the way. On her dying bed, she appeals to the prince to follow her path to truth. The Baron is ill and unable to see the Count. A note is brought to him from the Baron. The following message is written on it. "Return, dearest O, to whence you came. The prince no longer needs you or me. His debts have been paid. The cardinal, who lent him most of the money, is reconciled with him. Do you remember the Armenian who perplexed us so much last year? In his arms you will find the prince who 5 days since attended Mass for the first time." The prince has converted to Catholicism. With this conversion, the story breaks off. To conclude, please keep in mind that The Ghosts Here is the opposite of a realistic story. It belongs to the literary genre of the fantastic, where the possible and the impossible are presented simultaneously. They are often confounded, and the reader is meant to remain without a satisfying explanation. You remember the narrator's aim expressed at the beginning of the novel, which you heard in the first reading. He wanted his story to be a contribution to the history of the deception and aberrations of the human intellect. There is no doubt that the Armenian was behind the intrigue, the plot, which brought about the radical change in the prince. The ultimate aim was to bring about his conversion to Roman Catholicism, not out of religious conviction, but simply to extend the church's political power, for material gain. The prince's turbulent experiences with the Armenian and the Sicilian shook his solid base. His involvement with the secret society of the Bucentauro made him go through a phase of skepticism and free thinking, while the beautiful Greek woman further undermined his powers of self-determination through a mixture of sensuous attraction and religious ecstasy. Thank you very much.